Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1.
Hello and welcome to the programme. Today, Niall Hatch of Birdwatch Ireland reminds us that it's time once again to start thinking about garden birds. Éineann Ilona meets the Trinity professor, hoping to find plants with medicinal properties on our boglands. And we get the lowdown on nature conservation in South Africa from an Irishman working there.
As much as I'm a non-hunter and disagree with some of the trophy hunting, I cannot deny the facts that it takes money to protect these spaces. So if you're going to remove one of these mechanisms because you don't like it, because it's an emotional response, you are literally going to destroy the whole system that evolves, because the fact of the matter is photographic tourism cannot support the amount of land that currently is being supported under conservation using hunting and ecotourism. They are the facts. And that's, as a conservationist, that's what I work with. You know, maybe I go home at the end of the evening, cry into my pillow because it's not a perfect world, but this is the world we live in, and that's what people need to understand.
So, a very busy programme ahead of us today. Don't forget, you can visit the website anytime you like. It's rte.ie/Mooney. On the panel today, we've got Dr. Richard Collins, who's at his home in Malahide. Richard, how are you today?
Hello, Derek. I am very well indeed. I was out for my 5 kilometre walk around Robswall Park with Barbara this morning. We do it every morning. We see the sun come up. There was an extraordinary sight of the moon and the planet, and close to it, I think it's Venus. Anyway.
Well, we're going to have another full moon at the end of the month, the 30th of November, as far as I know.
Oh, very good. We had 2 full moons in the last month.
We did indeed, a blue moon. Do you know why it's called a blue moon, Richard?
I don't know why it's called blue, but there's a second one, all right. But why blue? Why not red? Why not anything?
Well,
do you know?
No idea. No, that's why I ask you. You're one of our experts. I usually defer to the experts on this programme. Maybe Niall Hatch will know. Niall Hatch is at his home in Kilcoole. Niall, do you know why it's called a blue moon in particular?
I must admit I don't. I know it's the origin of the expression once in a blue moon, which of course, it seems this year, is actually quite common. So maybe the expression needs to change.
Yeah, well, somebody listening will be able to tell us why the colour blue. We know what it refers to. It's 2 moons in the 1 month. Why is it the colour blue? Would somebody let us know? You can email mooney@rte.ie. Now, let's get into it straight away. This is the time of year when we should be thinking about garden birds.
Oh, absolutely, yes. The weather is turning. I'm sure the listeners can't have failed to have noticed that we're getting more unsettled weather. It's getting wetter, it's getting colder. And this is the time when birds will flock into our gardens. They're looking for a couple of things. They're looking for shelter and they're looking for food. They'll be the main drivers there. And they want somewhere that's secure from predators if possible. But that's when they really start to feel the pinch. So people will see over the coming weeks more and more birds coming into their gardens, especially if they have bird feeding stations or bird tables up to feed the birds. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's something that we would very much recommend.
So what should we put on the tables?
So variety is really the key here. So you're looking to attract as many different types of species as you can by putting a good variety of food. So one of the most important and traditional foods would be peanuts. So the peanuts are excellent for a range of species, including the blue tits and the great tits, the coal tits, and many other species too. Very important not to put them out loose, though. You should always put them into those wire mesh feeders that you can hang from a tree or from a bird table. That means that there's no risk of the birds choking. If they were to take a whole peanut, there's a chance they could swallow it and it could get lodged. But if they can just take a little morsel, a beakful through the mesh, then there's no problem with that whatsoever. Seeds are also great, and you can get
Just before you go on to the seeds, Niall, you want to emphasize that not salted peanuts.
Oh, absolutely, yes. So not salted peanuts. It's very important to make sure that they're the peanuts that are intended for the birds. Salt is very toxic to birds. Mm. Too much of it isn't great for us humans either, but it's even worse for the birds. It's also very important with peanuts to make sure that you give the birds very high quality ones. Make sure that they're not in any way wrinkled or especially moldy, because if mold grows on peanuts, it's pretty much harmless to us humans, but to the birds, it's incredibly toxic. So moldy peanuts are a big no-no there.
So the seeds, sorry, I interrupted you.
Yes, so seeds are another great source of food for birds. There's many different mixes you can get. In my own garden, I like to use pure black sunflower seed, and that attracts a range of different finches, particularly the birds that have those big beaks for crushing the seeds and taking the husks off and eating the kernels inside. So you can put them in special Perspex feeders. There's also some seed mixes you can get that you can put onto the ground, and some of the ground-feeding birds, like the robins and the blackbirds, will come and feed on those as well. Suet is another one that's always a popular food item with all sorts of birds. Suet essentially is the fat from around an animal's organs, especially its kidneys. And the reason why it's used to feed birds is because it stays very solid even at room temperature. So there's no chance of it melting or unfouling their feathers or going rancid. And there's many different commercial bird food cakes and fat balls, they call them, that you can hang up for the birds. They work very well. Fruit is another very important part of the diet for many birds. So you can get apples, cut them in half, spear them onto a branch or leave them on the lawn. And birds like blackbirds, song thrushes, missel thrushes, and then redwings and fieldfares are two migrant thrushes that only come to us for the winter. They'll thank you for those. They like apples very, very much. And these are birds that don't necessarily recognize other foods on bird tables as being edible because they don't really encounter them where they breed in northern and eastern Europe, in the case of the fieldfare, and in Iceland, particularly in the case of the redwing. And that works very well. And then finally, very important also, if you can put out water for them too, because sources of clean, fresh water are very important to birds. And as the temperatures drop and ponds and puddles freeze over, it becomes very difficult for birds to find liquid water. So even just putting a little dish of water out in your garden, even for a couple of hours a day, can make a big difference for them.
Richard.
I'm often approached by people who don't want to put stuff on a bird table because they say it's going to attract rats and nobody likes rats. Now, what I think you should do is get a tin tray and put it on the bird table and put the stuff on it that you want to feed to the birds. And then in the evening, before you go to bed, bring in the tray so that the rats are deprived of their bonanza. That's one thing. Another interesting trick, if you put out water, if there's a freeze-up, then the water is inaccessible. It'll be just ice. A trick with that is a biscuit tin and a night light, what we used to call long ago when we made May altars and things like that. We used to have night lights.
You made what, Richard?
May altars.
What's when a I was May a altar?
In the month of May, us Catholics always created a little altar at home when we were children. And you had a little light in front of it. And inside the light was this little candle called a night light. It was sold under that name. And you lit this. Well, now, those little candles, if you place one of them inside in the tray, in the tin box, the biscuit tin, and then you put a tray of water over it on a tin plate, the light coming up will keep the water from freezing, and so the birds will have water 24 hours a day.
Now, would you recommend putting out cream, Richard?
Cream?
Now, do you know why I'm asking you? Do you remember why I'm asking you, even? Think
I don't
now, think
should.
Now, think, what did you tell me about blue tits long ago? What were they doing with the milk bottles?
The famous 1929, was it? The blue tits in Southampton cottoned on that you could puncture the top of the bottles. In those days, the bottles of my youth had little cardboard things. And there was a milkman. He arrived in the early hour of the morning. And he had these 1 pint and 2 pint bottles with a little cardboard cap. Now, the blue tits tweaked that they could puncture that with their sharp little bills, and they're very sharp. I can tell you, when you ring them, you get sharp bites all the time from them. Now, they would puncture it and they would suck off the cream. The highly nutritious element would come to the top of the milk bottle and they would suck it off. And this spread throughout Britain and Ireland, and in about a year and a half or something like that, all blue tits all over Britain and Ireland
were doing
the same.
Yeah, now, how did they spread the message about this? This is what always intrigues me. When I come out of my estate in the morning, and if there's been a fall of rain, you often see the gulls on the grass doing the gull dance to get the worms to come to the surface so that they can pick off the worms. But I see it everywhere now. Everywhere I go in parklands, anywhere there's a bit of grass, I see the gulls doing that. How do they pass on the message that this is a good way to feed?
Well, gulls tend to go around in flocks. Anything that scavenges, that is hitting a source of food which is abundant if they find it. Remember, there's a greater weight of worms in the soil in a field than the weight of the cows on that field. So it's a hugely abundant resource. Now, if gulls find a resource, there's enough for everyone. And by staying together in flocks and cashing in on who is strong and is good at getting food, we'll all benefit without depriving the fellow who found the food of anything.
Okay, yeah, no, but you're still not answering my question about how this message gets passed on, this behaviour, because I know that blue tits flock, particularly at this time of year. In fact, I was with Niall the other day at the East Coast Nature Reserve, Niall, and we were looking at tits flocking together. There was great tits and blue tits, even goldcrests, were there not?
That's right. You remember how tiny those goldcrests were, the smallest bird in Ireland, smallest bird in Europe, in fact. And they are at the moment going around frantically trying to find food. The blue tits and the grey tits, as far as we can tell, are a bit smarter than the goldcrests. They're more adaptable and they are able to learn. So that's exactly what was going on with the milk bottle tops. Because as I remember, not only were the blue tits able to work out that they could get the cream from the top of the milk, they also knew what colour foil top had the most cream. So they'd go for the full fat one in preference to any of the skimmed milks. And it seems that they learned this by observing each other. So it was a learned behaviour. They saw other blue tits doing this and then picked up that habit
I know, but how does it spread from Southampton, you know, right across the United Kingdom, right into Ireland? You know, and right across Europe.
It could have spontaneously arisen in a couple of locations.
At the same time.
And then
time.
Pretty quickly they would learn. Because these birds move around a lot more than we think. They could move hundreds of kilometres over the course of a winter, some of them. Some of them would stay in very much in one location. But when we see blue tits coming backwards and forwards in our garden, we often think it's the same two or three. Studies have shown you may have 20, 25 different blue tits coming to your garden daily. So they move around a lot more than we think.
Actually, it's one of the nicest and most pleasant sights of winter for me is to see flocks of tits together. Especially if there's been a bit of a frost and you just see these birds alighting on the branches, and it looks gorgeous.
Oh, absolutely. Like, who wouldn't love to see those? They're such colourful birds. I think sometimes in Ireland, we take them a bit for granted because they're so common. If the blue tits and the grey tits were very rare birds, they would be highly sought after because they're incredibly beautiful. And people often say to me, oh, it's such a shame, you know, when you look at tropical countries, they have so many colourful species of birds with all these multicoloured feathers. And here in Ireland, we have nothing like that. But it's familiarity breeds contempt. We have blue tits, we have grey tits, we have kingfishers, we have remarkable looking birds. It's just we prefer the exotic, perhaps. Maybe that's what it is.
But back to the blue tits and the cream. Why do we not recommend putting out some cream for blue tits or for birds generally?
Well, there's a few things there. Of course, cream, it comes from milk, of course, which is a mammalian food. And cream contains a lot of lactose. And lactose for birds generally isn't great. They're not able to digest it properly. They never had any reason to evolve that because obviously birds don't feed milk to their young, unlike mammals. So they never built up any tolerance or enzymes to digest lactose. So a small amount of it, particularly if the blue tits were getting some fat from those milk bottle tops. Fat they can digest very well. Maybe only small amounts of lactose didn't cause them too many problems. And of course, they were only getting minuscule amounts from those milk bottles. They could only reach down so far. If you were to put a dish of cream out in the garden, however, there's a chance that they may start to try and feed one more of it. This could cause stomach upset and digestive problems. It could also mean that sometimes they would fall in or try to bathe in it. This would get on their feathers. It could foul them up. And of course, cream as well, if you leave it out at room temperature in the sunlight for any length of time, it's going to go rancid as well. So not the most pleasant of substances to have around the garden necessarily. So that's why instead of the soft fats, the oils that we get in like cream or things like that, it's much better to use the hard fats like suet that are going to remain solid and aren't going to cause any problems with going rancid, and that also don't contain lactose, which is obviously a type of sugar. Pure fat is better.
So do not leave out a cream. Okay, if you want to find out more about garden birds and how to feed them, Jim Wilson did a wonderful subsite for us some years ago, and we've reinstated it on our main frame. So just visit rte.ie/Mooney for Jim Wilson's guide to garden birds. Now, I don't know if you saw the papers last week, a story about hunting trips being organised to Ireland. And you can bring your rifle with you. And for about €850 or thereabouts, you spend 3 days in and around the Kerry area and you get the chance to shoot a stag. Anyway, needless to say, a lot of people are very unhappy about this, understandably. This is something we've discussed on the programme in the past. Not big game hunting in Ireland specifically, but in general. Most recently, we spoke to the founder for the campaign to ban trophy hunting.
Trophy hunting is very different from other kinds of hunting. It is not subsistence hunting. It's not about hunting animals for food. It is not some kind of cultural, traditional right. There isn't any material need being met by it. It is purely an entertainment business, if you like. So it is killing an animal for pleasure, for amusement, and then taking a part of that animal and displaying it and keeping it as a trophy, as a symbol of your prowess, if you like, or of your achievement in having tracked and shot that particular animal. And this is something that has grown into quite a major industry. So we now have very large numbers of animals, some of them quite endangered, which are being shot every year in every part of the world. So in Africa, North America, Asia, and so on and so forth. And it is something which arguably is helping to push some quite threatened species ever closer to that brink of extinction.
But as you know, there's two sides to every story. So to get the lowdown on what actually happens in some of these reserves, we're going to go now to South Africa and speak to an Irishman by the name of Neil Beddy. Neil works as a conservationist with private game reserves in the Limpopo region, from where he joins us now. Neil, thank you very much indeed for taking the time to speak with us. Can we begin by asking you to give us a little bit of background? How did you end up there?
Well, I qualified as a horticulturist from Glasnevin in 2007 and realised very quickly that the whole plant side of the world wasn't enough for me. I needed to know more about how everything fits in and works together across the spectrums of wildlife and the plant world. So I just took a gamble and went to South Africa. Someone told me I could become a ranger, and that's what I kind of set my sights on. And I pretty much knew within the first few days when I arrived to South Africa, that's where I needed to be, because there's such an incredible learning environment out here for people. It's very practical and you are straight up into the mix and spending a lot of time intensely learning. So that side of learning suited me. Then having to travel to these beautiful places that we have all around Ireland on a less of a regular basis. Someone told me I could go and live in those places and learn. So it kind of became an addiction, I suppose. It's once you're out in nature, it's very hard to go back to the human world.
Very different type of nature too. Can you describe the scene around you now?
I can. It's very dry. We haven't had proper rain since February. So it's what we call mopani felt is the main dominant type of tree out here. Like I said, there's not a lot of grass at the moment. All the shrubs are still brown. The sun is strong. The migrant birds are starting to return. We were just listening to the classes, cuckoo and the weavers. Both are in competition with each other. Basically, our camp revolves around a 1,000-year-old baobab. So it's giving us shade as it's starting to put out its leaves right now. I think the circumference of our one here is 28 meters, and I think a diameter of 10 meters equals 1,000 years. So this landscape is completely peppered with these type of trees that kind of tower over everything else and act as complete ecosystems in themselves, providing all sorts of refuge and food for all the wildlife out here.
You must think you've died and gone to heaven. You started off as a horticulturalist, you're interested in animals, and now you find yourself in South Africa, surrounded by all these wonderful creatures. Your work is with rhino mainly, I believe, so talk to me about that.
Yeah, we started with lions and wild dogs, and basically trained up as a wildlife monitor with various conservation companies and NPOs. And the main job was to go out and monitor some of these precious wildlife, collect data for researchers, consistent data, because we were the boots on the ground and the eyes on the ground. So I had an education in developing monitoring programs for such wildlife. And in 2013, there was, rhino poaching was on the rise, and there was quite a spike in an area of the northern Limpopo where I am now. So I was approached by a company that knew I'd been training extensively as a wildlife monitor, and asked if I could set up some monitoring programs for a few different reserves in this area who were still trying to protect the rhinos. Over the course of the last 8 years, we've developed a program where we go out twice a day, track and monitor any rhinos on these properties who are all fitted with VHF telemetry collars. And we find them, get their locations, take any kind of data we can, report the locations back to the reserve management so they know where they are first thing in the morning, and then we do it again at nighttime. Over time, we're able to build up movement maps and get a better understanding of how these animals move through these landscapes. But the main reason for these reserves the need for these monitoring programs is essentially security, not just security for the animals themselves, but security for the people that run it, because they're the ones that are at risk from poachers as well as the rhinos.
Are you fighting a losing battle? I read that in the last 10 years, some 10,000 animals have been poached.
I think the story for rhinos has been one of an ebb and flow. In the 70s, there was 150 white rhinos left in the whole of southern Africa and found in one national park called Shishlui in Mfolozi. And from that 150 animals, they have been able to re-establish a population of nearly 20,000. But, you know, all sorts of genetics have been lost throughout southern Africa because of such extreme poachings back then. But again, in 2008, there was a demand for rhino horn in Asia, mainly coming from Vietnam, a country with more infrastructure and more tourism and more money going into healthcare. So it became popular again to use rhino horn as a cure-all for everything. So we started seeing a spike in poaching in about 2008, mainly because a lot of the Asian species of rhinos, of which there's three left, are in very, very low numbers. The influence of poaching started to creep in across the entire southern continent, and we started losing rhinos heavily again. They would like to say that it's slowed over the last number of years, poaching, and it has. We've seen a decrease, but that's mainly because there is less rhinos and also because there's less people investing in the species on private reserves, just because they pose such a security risk. Essentially, you will hear the saying that, you know, rhinos, they're a bad investment, because you have to put so much of your annual income into protecting them with very little return. And now, if you can imagine how tourism has been completely annihilated because of the coronavirus, now you have reserves that have been trying to protect rhinos who are dependent on tourism, now have no means to protect those rhinos because tourism just stopped overnight. Now you're left with a very sad realization that you mightn't be able to stay in the fight after you've, you know, been in it for the last 10 years. So yeah, we're in a strange place right now. It's always concerning to hear what the media is saying, because it's not really an accurate portrayal of what's happening on the ground, but people are still fighting. People are still putting in whatever they have. And, you know, a lot of the private reserves are not subsidized by government to protect these animals. They really depend on the income they generate from running their businesses as nature reserves.
I wonder, are any of them thinking there's more money in the rhino horn than there is in getting tourists in? And whereas we're not getting any tourists in at the moment, why don't we just cull some rhinos? Is that going on there, do you know, even unofficially?
Well, no, I don't think so. There's such strict, you know, there's, I think, at the start of the year, some rhino horns slipped through. But if you have rhinos as a private reserve, you own them because you're investing in the species. But you have to have permits from the governing body in South Africa. So everything is permitted, everything is regulated. So if, like, we dehorned rhinos this year as part of our protection procedure for them, without them being dehorned, we are under constant threat from poachers. When we dehorned this year, which is, you know, literally taking a chainsaw to the horn and trying to get it as low, as much off as possible. Now, rhino horn is inert, so they have no feeling. It's like cutting your fingernails. But all the horns were microchipped, everything's documented, and then everything is taken away off location. So there isn't a market for it, you know, because the site is still, it's still banned on an international level. So, but you do have to wonder, and I'm not pro-trade in rhino horn, but when you're sitting out there, you know, 15 nights of the month and it's 2 o'clock in the morning and you're stressing about, is your job going to be cut because there's no money coming into the reserve, makes you think about, you know, the sale of rhino horn, and is that one avenue that we could go down to, you know, bring an income into protecting these animals again, especially at times when there's no other means to do it. So it's always in conflict.
Yeah, I'll bet it is. But ethical. Sorry for cutting you off. It kind of strikes me that if you take away the horns from a rhinoceros, you dehorn it, which is what you do in order to prevent it from being poached.
Yeah.
And once you take away the horn, it's no longer a rhinoceros. I mean, it gets its name from the fact that it has this horny nose.
Well, Derek, here's an open invite for you. You can come and meet a group of dehorned rhino, and I will show you they are very much still rhinos. You know, in fact, we are studying the effects of what's going on right now. This is not something that anybody wants to do, but it is the reality of the situation that we cannot handle the pressure that comes from poaching. Like, as normal people, just from our own mental welfare, if we have to be out there as protection teams, being under attack. I'm a conservationist. I didn't get into this to, you know, fight a war. I got into this so we could understand species in their natural landscapes and try and help them flourish. I'm not trained in a military sense. To stay in the fight, unfortunately, something has to give, and dehorning is something that's becoming more and more commonplace now because the alternatives are just disappearing. And I just make it clear for the listeners, these animals aren't dead most of the time when the poachers have taken an axe to their face. You know, these animals are just immobilized. They die sometime after. It's a big animal, and usually it's not one shot that kills it. So by the time the poacher gets to it and is removing the horn, the animal is most often still alive. So it's quite horrific. And the amount of actual rhinos that are poached that are females with the babies that are standing beside their mothers watching this whole scene unfold. It's actually quite
heartbreaking. It's pretty shocking, isn't it?
Think about it.
Richard.
The questions I always wanted to ask, but were afraid to ask when I was in South Africa. Now, there seem to be a great many reserves. You have 70 million people in South Africa, most of whom have no interest whatever in wildlife, but you have a huge tourist business. Now, you have thousands of these private reserves. Always wondered, how do they manage to make a living? Surely you can't get enough people to feed all these things and give the owners a profit.
Well, I think, you know, the international tourism is very different to the local-based tourism. You know, South Africans pay a lot less to go and visit their national parks than international tourists. So the international tourism is a huge revenue for the South African tourism industry, especially the wildlife industry. So, you know, reserves tend to not just be one tier or have one mechanism for managing it. And I mean, if your listeners know that a reserve generally is of a certain size and it has a fence around it. So once you erect fences, that means you're responsible for everything that happens inside. There isn't a free flow of animals. They're not migrating when the seasons change. So you have to generate an income to support these reserves. So that's the model of conservation in South Africa, is a sustainable use one, where they employ a few different mechanisms. For instance, majority of reserves would use hunting, ecotourism, and game sales, with an emerging market in venison, actually. It's like owning a shop and only selling one product and trying to stay afloat on a really nice pair of jeans when you could be selling all different types of jeans, you know? So if there's times where there's a lag in some part of the industry, then they have to fall back on a different mechanism, say it's game capture and selling animals to other reserves to generate an income. Hunting tends to generate the largest income, then ecotourism. But then again, not everybody can get to places that are far from the tourist hubs. And the places closest to the tourist hubs tend to be the areas that use mostly ecotourism with some hunting. And then the places further away from the tourist hubs tend to be more hunting and a little bit of ecotourism. There's a multiple use for generating an income that, like you asked there, keeps locals employed, keeps the fences intact, pumps water to boreholes so animals never run out of water. And in times of drought, which we've just had for the last 5 years, and bring feed to animals so they can just sustain through these dry seasons. I mean, it's a long time to go for an environment to have no rain from February all the way to where we are now. So a lot of people don't understand how the whole system works. It's kind of maybe one of the things that's enlightened me greatly, is arriving here and seeing ecotourism and then not being exposed to all the other mechanisms like game sales and hunting, and but not understanding why it took 3 years before I started understanding the whole model of conservation here. And the main reason is because there's some parts of it's taboo. It's not ideal, and people just don't understand it. But
it's a necessary evil, is what you're saying.
Yeah, this
whole thing. So in order for these reserves to survive, they've got to allow people to come onto the land and hunt big game.
A lot of places, that you know, they mightn't. It makes more business sense to do it, because at the end of the day, you're the custodian of an entire landscape. It can't fail. You know, you need to think 100 years into the future and what that business model is going to look like. That's the idea of the reserve being developed, is to support biodiversity and conservation. So, I mean, if you're not going to employ all of these mechanisms available to you to support the landscape, then you're kind of shooting yourself in the foot, whether you like it or not.
Yes, I was wondering about the private game reserves. I've been in them.
Yeah.
Now, it seems to me that they are, in a sense, free-ranged zoos. They're quite small. Okay. And usually the cantor sets out with the guide and the driver, and they're going to search for the big five kind of thing. Yeah. And they sort of give the impression that, oh, we'd be very lucky to see a leopard. Oh, we'd be very lucky if we came across maybe a white rhino, that sort of thing. And then they go out and they start looking at pug marks, and then the tension rises. But I suspected, I'm a very cynical person maybe, but I suspected that they knew hang well where the leopard was. We always managed to see a leopard. We always managed to see the rhino. We always managed to see the buffalo and the wildebeest. So it seemed to me that we're dealing here with a kind of a show. These fellows are good actors. They don't need really to be looking at bug marks on the ground and tracking through. And then we come on a lion and he's asleep and the car drives up right beside the lion and we lean over the sides. We could touch the huge lion. And so the impression created is that this is a kind of show. Is that accurate?
Well, it depends. It's called tourism for a reason, you know. Part of tourism is to be entertained. And you have to ask the question, you know, why are people going to these places? Are they going to these places because they want to protect wildlife? Or are they going to these places because they want to see the big five? You know, necessarily these animals don't need to see anybody, and they'd probably be way better off if they never saw anybody. But we have this infatuation with nature because we are nature, and we have that connection, even though we are have separated over times and we live in cities and have distanced ourselves completely from the natural world. But we are still drawn to see this stuff. And yes, some reserves are small, but you know, by and large, there's some absolutely massive reserves out there. And you have to understand that these are not just housing the charismatic animals that you just mentioned. They're also protecting grass, they're protecting trees, they're protecting insects, small mammals, everything that we don't think about. These reserves have created an environment for them to live in. It's habitat that was once agricultural land. That is the history of private reserves in South Africa. It was all agricultural land at one point, and we know what agricultural land is like. They're pastoral deserts. There's very little biodiversity. So for us as conservationists, it's all about compromise and understanding, you know, which is the lesser of the two evils. Ecotourism is imperfect, just as hunting is imperfect. But the fact of the matter is that's habitat that is supporting a wide range of wildlife, and that's what we need to remember.
Are you convinced, Richard?
Oh, yes. I'm not condemning this. I think it's excellent. And it's a great way to see these creatures. But you come on, and remember, one place, a dead impala, very strategically placed. And sure enough, there's the leopard over at the side. And the fellow running the show says, oh, my God, a leopard. Aha, my God. And, you know, and you realize that every time he takes them out, something like this is arranged in advance. But there's nothing wrong with that. I love deceiving the public. Yeah, after all, life is all about deception. Really, but the only thing, negative thing that occurs to me is that you might get a kind of inbreeding effect. The impression is that the whole of South Africa is little farm-like, foresty places hived off where there are animals, and they breed within it, but not with each other. So you might get kind of incestuous sort of arrangements. Is that a risk?
Well, that comes down to the management. You know, that's what a lot of people don't see. You know, I'm going on safari to South Africa. The guys have the Lion King experience in their head. When has anybody ever considered what it takes to run one of these reserves? I've had tourists arrive over here and we've taken them out to see the rhinos, and they ask where are the rest of the rhinos, and I say, what do you mean? Like, where are the rest of the rhinos in Africa? You know, they think that we're just going to drive around Africa and see all the rhinos. There's a part of the industry where we don't actually demonstrate what goes into running places like this and how they survive and the people that are involved in making it happen, and how actually, you know, there might be a fence, but you're connected to another reserve and it acts as a continuous zone. Animals don't understand fence lines. They'll move through it into another reserve. So there is a free flow of genetics. And if you are an owner of a reserve and you do have the hierarchy of predators, you're more than likely going to be introducing more prey species, because the predators within that space are just constantly lowering the amount of prey that's there. So if you don't have the hierarchy of prey species, then you have to manage your landscape intensely. Like, you got to manage for habitat, because if you don't have a habitat, then you don't have species. And that's why we have a system of game capture where animals are caught at mass capture, and, you know, there'll be a reserve to say, hey, I need 100 new impala because I want to bring in new genetics. It's like, it's very well managed. It's a very, very, very well managed system that has, you know, started taking hold in the early 70s.
Richard, we'd probably do it here if we had the same number of animals and we had the big five.
Indeed we would. Yes, they do it everywhere. You see this in India and Southeast Asia. Everywhere you go, you have this sort of stress. And there's nothing wrong with it, nothing inherently wrong with it, provided the biological needs of the animals are carefully taken care of.
Well, can I just clarify with something with you then in that case, Richard? Now that you know this and you understand what's going on and you've been to these reserves on more than one occasion, are you happy going to a reserve to see animals where you know that in order to make a crust, they also allow fellas in to shoot the same animals?
Well, that's a moral question. Now, there's two sides to that. First of all, there is the impact that the shooting may have on the populations of animals. There can be actions which don't lead to reduction damage to the population, which are nonetheless reprehensible. In other words, things that cause unnecessary cruelty or harassment or pain to the animals. Now, on the hunting...
It requires a simple yes or no, Richard.
It doesn't.
It does, because I asked you, are you happy going onto a reserve knowing that this is what's taking place? So, yes or no?
Well, when I go out to the Irish Nature Reserve, the ducks are being shot, and I have to accept that. I mean, death is part of life, and if the populations need to be culled, then, of course, it is acceptable. We are hunters. There is nothing wrong with that.
You wouldn't do it yourself? You wouldn't pick up a rifle and shoot a rhino?
Oh God, no, I wouldn't shoot anything. I don't. The whole idea is reprehensible to me.
Niall, how do you feel about it?
I feel very much like Richard does. I think that Neil has done a fantastic job there of explaining the sort of dichotomy that's there, the compromises that are needed in the real world when it comes to conservation. And as a conservationist myself, I can very much relate to that. In an ideal world, this wouldn't be necessary. Even reserves wouldn't be necessary, but we live far from an ideal world. And I can definitely see why having economic value, be it from hunting or from ecotourism or kind of viewing like this, can be very important for the conservation of species, even though that itself may harm some of those individual animals. It's an unpleasant situation. It's not something that a lot of conservationists start off thinking that they'll get involved with or will be associated with their work, but it is necessary. And I think that one of the important parts there as well, and I think you touched on it very well, Neil, when you're talking about preserving this big game, be it for hunting or for photography or for viewing or whatever, they're sort of really the tip of the iceberg. To support those animals, you have the whole ecosystem below them, all of the insects and the plants and the birds and the reptiles and the small mammals. They're all being conserved as well. And in some ways, I suppose that these big game are serving as flagships that actually help to conserve a whole much wider world and keep that ecosystem as maintained as it can be in a very highly populated and modern country. It's amazing that there's wildlife at all there in many cases, I think.
As much as I'm a non-hunter and disagree with some of the trophy hunting, I cannot deny the facts and remove my emotions from the situation. And I cannot deny the facts that it takes money to protect these spaces. So if you're going to remove one of these mechanisms because you don't like it, because it's an emotional response, you are literally going to destroy the whole system that evolves, because the fact of the matter is photographic tourism cannot support the amount of land that currently is being supported under conservation using hunting, and ecotourism. They are the facts. And that's, as a conservationist, that's what I work with. You know, maybe I go home at the end of the evening, cry into my pillow because it's not a perfect world, but this is the world we live in. And that's what people need to understand. Africans and Africa is getting extremely agitated with outsiders' impression of and interference with what is going on here. And they're actually limiting their ability to protect these places by banning imports of trophies or having an opinion in societies that red lists an animal. You're removing the ability of places to care for these animals and to sustainably use them, because if they can make some sort of income from their wildlife, then they have a reason to protect it. They are the hard facts, and no matter what any people say about it, that's what we have to focus on to get the job done, to protect spaces.
Well, I don't think I'll ever look at this story the same way again. I feel better informed having spoken with you, Neil. We really do appreciate it. Thank you very much indeed.
Okay. Oh, you're very welcome. Anytime. Thank you so much.
And you can have a look and see where Neil works. There's pictures on our website, rte.ie/Mooney. Now, the general public are aware of the threat to the world's rainforests, the reduction of biodiversity and the potential disappearance of potential medicines and other natural extracts. The same threat to biodiversity applies in Ireland, particularly to our boglands, which constitute an enormous national resource and heritage. So says Dr. Helen Sheridan. Helen is Associate Professor of Pharmacy and Pharmaceutical Sciences at Trinity College Dublin. Trinity has secured significant funding to examine the untapped social, cultural and economic benefits of our boglands. Aine and Ilana spoke with Helen earlier.
I'm speaking to Helen Sheridan. Helen is the Associate Professor of Pharmacy and Pharmaceutical Sciences at Trinity College Dublin. And Helen tells me that Trinity has secured significant funding to examine the untapped social, cultural and economic benefits of our boglands. Helen, tell me more.
Well, it's lovely to speak to you, Aine. This is a really exciting project, and it was quite serendipitous to receive funding for research in this area. The boglands of Ireland are a unique environment for us, and I suppose with the reduction now in peat harvesting, there's an opportunity to look at this resource and to try and maximise the benefits from it. I'm not a bog specialist by any means. My expertise is that I'm a natural product chemist, and I work looking to find new treatments for disease or to find new ways forward for molecules from the natural world. And so I have been given the resources now to turn my lens of science on the bogland regions and to try and find what treasures there may be there, and also to try and derive benefit from this unlocked resource that will help establish possibly new industries and to create an awareness, but also maybe economic benefits through employment or through growing new species in these areas.
And this all sounds very exciting, but in actual fact, you just picked the bogs because they are a native resource and you're going to look for species with high therapeutic value. Now, do the bogs actually have any high therapeutic value species that we know of already? Why pick on the bogs? Why not do sand dune flora or somewhere else? I mean, why bogs? Well, are they any particular speciality there? Are they any good for keep making us well? Have we any knowledge to work on? Or is it just because you just picked this area because that's where the money is for?
It's a little bit of both, really. I mean, the opportunity came to look at this biodiversity, but there's plenty of precedent. And so one area that I also work in is in ethnopharmacology. And we have been looking at an archive that exists in Ireland that was created in the 1930s.
Now, wait a moment, what is ethnopharmacology? You might know what it is, but you know, many other people do.
I'm sorry. It's looking at the traditional use of plants by cultures. And for many years, like in Ireland, the research we did was actually in other countries. It wasn't in Ireland. So I've worked with plants and traditional use of medicines in sub-Saharan Africa and in South America and in Asia. And the opportunity came to turn that same kind of scientific ability and look at our own traditional use of plants in Irish environments. And so the boglands are a unique resource. Nobody has really looked at them in this way before. And the ethnopharmacology, that big word, which is looking at the traditional use of plant materials in Ireland, we have an established cultural use of plants in boglands and plants as herbal medicines across the country, going back like to the Middle Ages and long before.
Yeah, so tell me, give me an example of some plants in the bog that people used to fix themselves when they were sick.
The examples would be things like people who live in the Midlands or who live in bogland areas around the peripheries of Ireland maybe know about a plant called bog myrtle. And bog myrtle is Mercia Galli in Latin. And this plant grows along the west coast, it's down in Kerry, it's up in many of the bogs. And it was used traditionally by farmers. They'd take little, or people working in the bogs harvesting turf, would take a little branch of this or a sprig of it and wear it in their jacket or wear it around their collar, around their neck. They'd also attach it to some of their animals because it was believed to have insect repellent properties. And so it was used traditionally to keep away mites.
Have you ever tried it?
No, but there's a guy I've been chatting to in Chagas who has used it a lot and is a specialist in the use of this particular plant and considers it to be like a national resource. It does grow in other bogland territories outside Ireland, but that's only one example. People would be familiar with...
I've tried it umpteen times when I'm attacked by midges on the bog, unless you have it tied onto your hat loose and it swings and knocks away the flies. I don't know, maybe it didn't...
You're not sure about the chemistry.
Anyway,
yeah.
No, so that's the medical end of it. So you're going to look at different plants and you're going to see, are there any actual molecules? Because, I mean, all of our medicines do, in fact, come from plants. I mean, we think of things like, say, willow and the bark of the willow salix, and we get salicylic acid, which is aspirin. So, I mean, you know, it's not beyond the bounds of possibility that there are undiscovered medicines in bog plants indeed. So looking at these for these molecules will certainly, as you say, do something that hasn't been done before.
Yeah, but we're also quite interested in looking at the microflora, like looking also at the microbes that grow in around the roots of the plants in the boglands and in that are present in bog waters and that are present in other species, not just the traditional plants, but things like lichens, where, you know, you've got different types of plant species growing that can be rich in different small molecules. We're also interested in trying to find new antibiotics, particularly because of drug-resistant infections that are out there. So it's an opportunity to do really exciting science on species that we're familiar with, but we're also going to try and engage with communities who are traditionally living in these areas, who also use plant species and still use them and have great respect for them. And to that end, we've been working with Chagas and with a number of individual groups and small organisations across the country who are harvesting plants for us for this study.
Yeah, I see, apart from these medical things, you're talking about cosmetics. Does that mean some of the plants traditionally were used for people's skin or for making them look better or this sort of thing? I know certainly eyebright is one you get on the sand dunes to make your eyes dilated. On the bogs, I'm sure there are something similar to those.
Well, we have one that we're interested in, or we've several, but I'll give you an example. Galium verum, which is known as lady's bedstraw. This was used historically and traditionally in Ireland to treat inflammation. It was used in poultices and a variety of other topical applications. So we would be interested in seeing what's in that particular plant that could possibly be incorporated into a cosmetic product made locally in these communities, you know, where you could start up small industries. Or there are existing industries working with cosmetics, on natural cosmetics, that we could add to their repertoire of plants that could be used as extracts, because many plant species are used topically for inflammation. And we also, now you see, I suppose science has moved on so much, we know that there are various enzymes in the human body that plant extracts can interact with. And one thing we'd be interested in is something that stops skin getting uneven pigmentation. I would anyway, I'm over 60. So to me, like my skin now, these things, people keep saying, oh, what's that, Ellen? And it's an age spot, another one. So we'd be looking for extracts that you could incorporate into creams that then you could use that would reduce this type of effect. And the cosmetic industry are really interested in that. And my view is, I suppose, as in the area I'm in, I think there's huge potential to enrich industries that we have here and to change maybe some of the things we're doing to cultivate plants that have values, higher values in other places. So in addition to all of the bog plants, maybe there are medicinal plants and herbal plants that already have high international value that could be grown in these areas or
cultivated. Yeah, I wanted to ask you that. I mean, we've just finished, or at least practically, hopefully soon, finished harvesting our bogs, taking away the top skin and then removing all the peat. And, you know, the thought would have been that they might be drains blocked up and they restored back to functioning bogs again where possible. But if you find some wonderful plant that's absolutely going to save the world or save people or be an antibiotic, does this mean that it'll be grown on the bogs and they'll just become a monoculture for that particular plant? I mean, how do you see the production of the wonderful thing that you will find?
Well, yeah, that's a really good question. Of course, it's a hard question to answer. I mean, there's plenty of experts who are involved in agriculture throughout the country. We've spoken, as I said, with Chagas and with various different organisations who have ideas of kind of being able to grow small or to do scaled growth of some species, but not necessarily on the boglands. So you've got the whole conversation there about, you know, what do we do with them? Do we let them get restored? I'm not a bog specialist, but what I can do is find species that could be cultivated possibly in depleted soil or in marginal soil, not necessarily to turn our bogs into monoculture. You know, we are reliant on a limited number of crops. And if we can find new species that have high value in international markets, it's my view we should try and include those within our vision for crops in Ireland. So not to use the bogs to grow them on, but let's see what there might be there that we could grow in different ways. And then there may be areas, as I say, depleted soil where you could grow some high value herbal medicinal products. I know that Bord na Mona are exploring this at the moment, or in several different areas in the Midlands, and they are very successfully growing species that have very good medicinal properties and qualities. So I don't know where we will grow them, but let's find them first. That'll be my thoughts.
How can this funding examine the untapped social and cultural benefits of our boglands? You know, where are you going with that one?
Well, this grant is huge, like, so part of a huge allocation.
How much is it as a matter of interest?
It's worth €6 million. Yeah. And to my mind, that's large because it's money that we...
It certainly is, yeah. Yeah. Well done.
And,
yeah.
And I think it's a responsibility. So I think the responsibility in having that kind of funding is to try and impact on as many levels as possible. And the social and cultural will be, how do we actually work to make it a sustainable resource that can contribute to the economy while adhering with whatever we need to do to keep global warming at bay, etc. So our plan is to have extensive outreach involving citizen science and citizen engagement. The way we see it is that the biggest impact of, you know, the whole shutdown in harvesting bog and its pivotal role in certainly in the Midlands in terms of employment, that is that we have to try and use this money to create opportunity that gives people, you know, access to more work if possible, but maybe in more creative ways. And so the social and cultural would be like the cultural role of the bogs has been huge. And the change in lifestyle because of the change in how we're working with the bogs has had a huge impact on people in terms of employment, but also the morale and the sense of continuity of tradition and all of those areas. So what our plan is to work through citizen science and engagement with communities, with various organisations and bodies across regions affected by this to try and find out what they're looking for, firstly, but also to try and capture the cultural knowledge and tradition of the bogs in some valuable forms that can be long lasting. We had an idea originally of having like a travelling museum or a museum that could be, you know, moved between schools and communities and that. And that's a bit more expensive than we can accommodate. But our idea is not to reinvent the wheel, but to work with other bodies that are out there, like the IPCC. And there's a big life project being that was funded by the EU. And there's various and Chagas, as I said, to build capacity outside like science that is focused on bog stories, the culture of use of the bog. We're launching a number of competitions later in the year, and we're hoping to align a particular area of citizen science with the Young Scientists exhibition to allow for both the science but also the cultural elements of bog life and bog history.
Well, it all sounds very exciting, and you must be congratulated on having this award. So well done and good luck in the future. Keep in touch with us so we hear your results as they go along instead of having to wait 4 years for the final report.
Okay, thank you very much. Bye bye.
And more details again on the website, rte.ie/money. That's pretty much all we have time for today. My thanks to Niall Hatch, to Richard Collins, to Aina Nilana. Our broadcast coordinator is Jarlath Holland. Our researcher is John Bella Riley. And on sound, we had Shilini Vuil. Until next time, goodbye.
Visit the website, rte.ie/Mooney.
Mooney Goes Wild was presented and produced by Derek Mooney.